Okay. I mentioned last week that I got flack for last week's shiur before I gave it, because I entitled this shiur, "Did Golus a Glorious Mission?" A glorious mission. Now, this concept makes people uncomfortable. Certain people, which really comes from a lack of understanding of everything we've been discussing this last week. But there is a tendency, people would prefer to understand that Golus really just represents the loserish state of the Jewish people. As long as the Jews were not their own rulers, it was just one big disgrace. Now that we have a country again, now that we have our own government, Jewish pride has come back to life, and therefore we just rather forget about that whole period. It's just one big stain on our history, which, as we already mentioned last week, is really a blasphemous approach. It's really based on lack of understanding, but it has to be clarified. We already saw the Kuzari bringing up the concept last week. I'll put it into different terms. Who do we say is more of a Jewish hero? A martyr who gave up his life, rather be burnt at the stake, than accept Christianity? Or a Jewish judo champion? Who's more of a pride to the Jewish people? Do we say that the first one is actually a disgrace because it's just another manifestation of Jewish loserishness? Whereas the second one, there's Jewish pride. And the truth is that this also very much depends on whether you, and here's the challenge, this really is the challenge of Jewish outlook in general, relating to things on a material level or relating to things on the spiritual level. If you relate to things on a material level, a nation that's bouncing around from place to place and doesn't have a homeland is a loser of a nation. That's true. A nation that does have a homeland has a, well, semi-functioning government and has their own military is already a nation that can be proud. If that's what the Jewish people boil down to, then this understanding is correct. But a most fundamental aspect of our faith is that by us it's all about the spiritual. And we're meant to relate to anything material from the spiritual perspective. We're meant to relate to anything physical from the spiritual perspective. If we're relating things from the spiritual perspective, yes, in Judaism, a pauper can be a hero, right? A person who in the outside world is just a loser, in Judaism can be a hero, because it all depends on your performance on the spiritual plane. And the same goes for the national level. Yes, we had generations of downtrodden, poor heroes. But Lamaisa, I want to stop my own dissertation on this subject, and I'm going to hand the microphone over to Rav Shimshon Paul Hirsch. Certainly a more authoritative source than myself. And really, what we're going to see here is exactly what we saw in the Kuzari last week. Rabbi Hirsch spells out at length and clarifies perfectly what our outlook on the Golus is meant to be. But I'm going to just preface it with just one very basic statement. Again, basically someone wrote to me last week that to term Golus as a glorious mission is a sacrilege. To term Golus as a glorious mission is a sacrilege. So I just want to ask ourselves, I didn't respond to the email, but I just want to ask ourselves two basic questions. Is everything that happened to the Jewish nation orchestrated by Hashem? Yeah, okay. So Golus was not a freak accident. Now, is anything that Hashem sends our way meant to be understood as a mission? Yes. Is any mission presented us by Hashem glorious? Yes. There's no two ways about it. Any mission that Hashem imposes upon us is a glorious opportunity. Right? We might say It's not a fortunate way of playing it out. We might say it would have been better if we wouldn't have had to go into Golis in the first place. And yes, for that first generation it was a punishment, but for those of us born in Golis, Golis, by definition, it's orchestrated by Hashem, it's a mission. If it's a mission imposed on us by Hashem, it's a glorious mission. As far as I'm concerned, it's basic math. We're getting back to what we saw in the Kuzari last week. But I want, just in order to have this very clear, because there's a lot of confusion about this out there, I want to simply read Rav Hirsch from two sources, the 19 letters and Chorev. The 19 letters is basically a condensed debut of Rav Hirsch. He wrote book Chorev, which is this thick. Okay? The publishers were scared to touch it. This book is about what was at the time a very unpopular subject, traditional Judaism. Right? It was going out of style at that point. And which publisher wants to put out a 700-page book? So, therefore, Rav Hirsch wrote another book, The 19 Letters, which is actually much thinner than this. This is with a lot of notes, etc., etc. It's a very thin book, which basically was a pilot. He wanted to get himself out and show what his agenda is. If that would be well received, the publishers would have the courage to go ahead and put out the big work. So in the 19 letters, he's kind of laying down, it's written in the form of a, kind of like Kuzari, a dialogue between what they called a progressive Jew, who couldn't understand all the old ways, and the old-fashioned Jew, who was representing old traditional Judaism. So here, he has the 9th letter is entitled Exile. And here's where he really puts this into the perfect perspective. And this is very fundamental to understand, because this really is where the stand of many of the Gedolei Yisroel, who had certain reservations of the concept of Jewish sovereignty in our current state, this is really what's behind it. Even though they never took the trouble of spelling it out, Rav Hirsch did. So, let's see. It's exile. Here's how he begins this letter. Only for a short time did Israel attain its ideal, the fulfillment of its mission amidst prosperity. Moshe, its first leader, had already prophetically foretold that Israel would forget God while living on his soil, and, led astray by its own, by the nations and its own posterity, would cling to its wealth and pleasures and forget its true task. Thus, there came the time when the people of Israel would quote the prophet to lament. Listen to this. The number of your cities has become your god, O Yehuda. Rav Hirsch is making a very original twist on this pasuk. Pasuk says, Ki mispar orecho hayu eloheicho Yisrael. Simply understood, that pasuk means you have as many gods as you have cities. Every city has another god. Rav Hirsch is translating it literally. Your number of cities has become your god, meaning you've lost focus. You've stopped seeing the land as a means to serving God, and it became an end. In and of itself, what you started worshipping. You started worshipping the number of cities you have. How many cities do we have? One more, one less? That became a form of worship. Hence, Israel had to be deprived of prosperity. Why again? Because they failed the test. Prosperity caused them to forget the point, to remain focused. Hence, Israel had to be deprived of prosperity, wealth, and land, which had led it astray. It had to leave the soil on which it had enjoyed happiness, and which had made it arrogantly forsake its duty. It could salvage nothing, meaning when it went into Galus, it could salvage nothing but the life spark of its existence, the Torah. From now on, the only bond that would unite Israel would be God and its calling, a spiritual and therefore indestructible bond. In other words, what he's saying is that Israel have to keep conscious of the fact that at the end of their essence is nothing material. Everything material, including the land itself, is a means to the essence, which is spiritual, their relationship with Hashem. And if, instead of using the land as a means toward that, the land became an end in itself, if prosperity started misleading them, everything has to be taken away except that bond, and cause them to just focus on that. That is the purpose of Galus, as he's now going to spell out. The purpose of Galus was for the Jews to be able to now spend some time just focusing on the essence. Once they can reconnect with that, with their spiritual duty enough, they can be granted the chance of trying again. Let's understand, it's a challenge to integrate the spiritual with the physical. Because the physical, since we're physical people, will be drawn after the physical. Right? To be able to be involved on the material level, but yet retain the spiritual approach is tough. And therefore, in order to make it easier for us, on the spiritual level, not on the material level, Hashem took away the material distraction. Regain the focus on the spiritual, then we'll try again. It's a very profound way of understanding it. Thus, Yisrael's mission was indeed not rescinded when its statehood came to an end. For after all, statehood had been meant only as a tool to further this mission. Rather, the ruin of the state was itself part and parcel of Yisrael's destiny, which was to bring about the revelation of God and of man's calling. In its dispersion, it was called upon merely to unveil a different facet of the task that it was to fulfill. In fact, as a state, Yisrael had committed no sins other than those evident among all the other nations. But that which could be tolerated in the case of other people could not be excused in Yisrael. For the entire purpose of his existence was to remain pure of such aberrations, since Hashem was its God. The collapse of the state then served in its way to educate Yisrael just as much as its former prosperity had done, and its dispersion opened a new, great, far-flung field in which to carry out its mission. There he lays it down in the 19 letters. And I want to take it further, where he elaborates on this a bit more in Chorin. He does it in two places. We're going to see. Here he discusses it in the concept of what he calls the mitzvah lidrosh b'shlema malchus. The mitzvah, basically, of when we're in the Galus, to be a loyal citizen, a loyal and faithful citizen of the country you live in. So I'm not reading his whole essay on the matter, but the relevant part. When Israel was still united in the common land, they did not call themselves Am. This is also a very interesting chiddush of Reb Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. He observes this, that the term Am is not used when they're in Eretz Yisrael, one people, for the reason that one common soil bore them all. Meaning, why are most nations called a nation? What defines a nation? Statehood, obviously. Right? Once a nation moves, it assimilates with the new nation, loses its identity. Right? The Indian nation is a nation that lives in India. In the case of the Jews, that's not true. They're not called a nation because they live on common ground. That's not what makes them into a nation. For, alone among all the people of the earth, the possession of the land and the ensuing organization of the state was for Israel not an end but a means to the better fulfillment of their Jewish duties. Now listen to this sentence, a very fundamental sentence, again in understanding a lot of things that there's a lot of confusion about today. The Torah did not exist for the state, but the state for the Torah. And only the Torah. The idea of being joint bearers of a spiritual calling fused the individuals into an association of human beings whose inner cohesiveness is reflected in the term Am. Meaning we're called Am in the sense that we are united through Torah. The land is a very chush of a part of it, but that is not the essential definition of Kol Yisrael as an Am. Now, even later on, far away from her land, when Israel sees her visible bonds of nationhood broken, the dispersed Jews call themselves Am, one nation. We remain a nation, one nation, even when we're all around the globe. Even when there are Jews in Spain, Sephardic African Jews, Ashkenazic European Jews, we still remain one nation. Why? Not in remembrance of a land once jointly possessed, not looking towards the future when God as his words through the prophets teach us, will once more have united them. But in the consciousness of being in the present as in the past, bearers of an eternal idea, an eternal mission, and of a God-given destiny which, in Israel, overshadowed, meaning in the nation of Israel, overshadowed and still overshadows the existence of the state, and which therefore had survived the state's downfall. We mourn over the sin which brought about that downfall. We take to heart the harshness which we have encountered in our years of wandering as the chastisement of a father imposed upon us for our improvement. And we mourn the lack of observance of the Torah which that ruin has brought about. Now, why do we long to come back? This is very fundamental. Not in order to shine as a nation among nations do we raise our prayers and hopes for a reunion in our land. But in order to find the soil, meaning in other words, what's he saying? Not to shine, is very fundamental words, not to shine as a nation among nations. Meaning the point is not to show the rest of the world, we can also do what the rest of you are doing. We can have an army. We can have Olympic champions. We can provide great doctors just like everybody else. The Jews did that outside of Eretz Yisrael too. But, I don't know about judo champions, but great doctors. But, we don't compete with the guy on their level. For us, statehood means something completely different than it means to them. By the rest of the world, national success are issues of financial success, military success, etc. The stronger the military, the more of a proud nation you are. But by us, we're operating at a completely different level. We don't have issues of national pride. Therefore, for us, tells us later, that we don't have a problem when we are in Golos, bowing our head before some bully and saying, okay, you want this, we'll give you this, you want that, we'll give you that. Because our pride does not lie in the fact that we can assert ourselves and we can show that people can't push us around. Our happiness, our success as a nation lies in operating on our elevated sphere, the sphere of spirituality. We just want to be left alone in order to do that. If it works better, subjugated to other nations, fine. If it works better as sovereigns on our own soil, fine. But it's all for that purpose. So therefore, again, not in order to shine as a nation among other nations do we raise our prayers and hopes for a reunion in our land. But in order to find a soil for the better fulfillment of our spiritual vocation in that reunion and in the land which was promised and given, and again promised for our observance of the Torah. But this very vocation obliges us, until God shall call us back to the Holy Land, to live and work as patriots wherever He placed us, to collect all the physical, material, and spiritual forces, and all that is noble in Israel, to further the weal of the nations that have given us shelter. Okay. Now, he moves on to explain that this also explains a deep Gemara, which is also subject to a lot of ambiguity in today's day and age. But you know what? Let's read what he says. Let's see what he says all the way through. It obliges us further. Now listen here. Here, close your ears. It obliges us further to allow our longing for the far-off land to express itself only in longing, in wishing, and hoping, and only through the honest of all Jewish duties to await the realization of this hope. Meaning, in other words, if we think that regaining Jewish pride is an issue of us pushing for the development and for the building of a state on the material level, we're missing the point. The whole point of the Golus was to rectify the mistakes that caused that Golus in the first place. Right? Now again, I'm not going to get into the argument of whether the state, yes, no, maybe so on. I'm saying is one thing that I believe is unanimously agreed upon on the higher rabbinic level. Whatever you... that the purpose of Golus and the primary means of rectifying that is by fixing the spiritual mistakes. Let's say you can come We were sent away because we lost focus. So to come back to the state, plant our lost focus on the spiritual dreams. To come back, plant ourselves in the state again. When we still have that same mindset of focusing on the material, what will we have gained? And we'll have missed the point. So therefore he says, and listen to this, and here he's basically expressing what's really the hashkafa of many of the Gedolei Yisrael, even though on the one hand, they didn't make a point of formulating it and publicizing it, and on the other hand, it's also been very squelched. But we have to at least, for once, give expression to the views of people like the Chazon Ish, the Chofetz Chaim, and others, even if in a general way, in modern society, it's not appreciated as much. But really, that's what he's spelling out here. So listen to this. So again, how do we go about, how do we manifest that hope? How do we manifest that striving to be reunited on the land? Through spiritual efforts, through working, like we said last week, to acknowledge that this is imposed upon us by Hashem, to acknowledge the reasons it was imposed upon us, to tenaciously cling to all the things that Hashem wants us to cling to, and to show, look, yes, you gave us a period of just focusing on that bare essence of what it means to be Jewish, meaning Torah, 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 our relationship with Hashem, and that's all. That's what we're focusing on, and through that we're trying to achieve being brought back. Now listen to this. But it forbids us to drive for the reunion or the possession of the land by any but spiritual means. Our sages say that God imposed three vows when he sent Israel out into the Golis. That the children of Israel shall never seek to reestablish their nation by themselves. Now again, you know, I'm not going to get into the argument of how that works today. One might be able to make an argument that, well, we'll see soon, then we'll be able to. That's number one. Meaning again, if the Jews were sent out to Golis, and then they go figure, oh, we can solve the problem, well, go there and start building again. Well, I've missed the point. Two, that they shall never be disloyal to the nations which have given them shelter. Three, that these nations, meaning in other words, the way the Gemara terms this is, don't rebel against the nations. Meaning again, there's a very fundamental point here. When we say we're not supposed to be provoking the nations, right? Sometimes that comes across as a chickenish kind of approach, right? We're not supposed to be provoking the nations. What's the fundamental point behind it? The fundamental point behind it is really the same point. There's a focus, and there are all kinds of things that can distract us from that focus. We're meant to be focused on spirituality. Once for us, national pride means showing that we can be as strong as anybody else and that no one can push us around, that will quickly turn into the focus. I'll give a pashut example. When I was in yeshiva, my yeshiva was located in a black neighborhood. And there were always fights with the neighborhood guys. Right? Now, the guys who were involved in it, you know, that obviously became, it was very, you wouldn't find people who were really into the learning and also into that, because that turns into, it's a whole separate agenda, right? I mean, you need to be able to assert yourself and show yourself and no one can push me around and all that, right? Once we start focusing on, right, showing that we can stand up for ourselves, that will turn into a national focus and will distract us from our true focus. The reason that we're enjoined, you know what, just bow your heads, don't provoke them, is for the purpose of remaining focused. A person can't have too many agendas that he dedicates himself to with full vigor, right? If our focus turns into showing the world what we can do, showing the world how Jews can also provide judo champions, we're going to have a very hard time focusing on the spiritual level. Say, for example, right? Father sends his kid off to university. Very chush of a high class university. Well, I much like the example I gave. But it's situated in a low class area. And you have the guys who, when all the bums outside start up with them, they lower their heads, rush back into the university, and head back to the laboratories. And then you have the guys who are out there fighting with the neighborhood kids all day. We have to show them that they can't mess and push us around. Who's the mice are going to succeed more? Right? If you just decide, forget it, I'm not on their level. What interests them doesn't interest me. For them, the most important thing is to show that they're stronger. You know what? Be stronger. Just let me work in the lab. Right? So that's the point. Don't allow other national agendas to distract you from what you're supposed to be focused on. Okay. This, I think, explains a little bit more detail what the Guzari meant by saying, again, the words he used when he said that if we would tolerate this galus and the downtroddenness for the sake of Hashem properly, we would be the glory of the generation that we're waiting for when Mashiach comes, and we would bring about that longed for salvation much quicker. That's how the Kuzari put it into a short two sentences, and we've seen Rav Hirsch elaborate it at length. I think seeing what he says suffices, and I think that serves just to put down a fundamental perspective, which is important to hear at least once. Now we move on in the Kuzari. And here he basically goes, he's kind of like, we're really summing up this whole discussion, and he's moving into a kind of bouncing from point to point, summing up the points. If you remember last week, we saw the Kuzari king making fun of the different religions that say, you know, they're so desperate in their evangelist efforts that it's just say the word, and then you have achieved eternal salvation, right? Say the word, I accept Yashka, and you've made it, right? So the Kuzari king kind of pokes fun at that. He said, what? You can have a person who dedicates his life to character, to improvement, to character perfection, etc. But he never said the magic words, I accept Yashka. So he's destined for eternal damnation. And then you have a boor who always cheated everybody around him and always beat his wife, etc., etc. But he said the magic words. He said the magic words, I accept Yashka. And therefore, he is destined for eternal bliss. The magic words. That's very important for the Christians because, again, there is no real legitimacy there, so they depend on people validating them. So therefore, yes, you can earn your eternity through just say those magic words. So, the Kuzari king made fun of that one, sorry? Well, I mean, now we're talking about joining the faith. We'll see. We're talking about joining the faith. But the truth is that even that, you're talking about tshuva. Tshuva is not just an issue of words at all. Part of the chiyuv of tshuva is to articulate it, but the essence of tshuva is assuming a completely new behavior. Right? So now, what do you say as far as joining the faith goes? How does Judaism approach that? So now he says, "Vanachnu ein anachnu mashvim im nafshesenu." No, we will never grant somebody equal footing with us by means of a word. No such thing. You say, I believe, right? Magic word. No. You want to earn that status? You want to earn our eternal existence? You have to prove yourself through things that are not easy. Let's see. Mitara, you have to purify yourself, meaning a lot of good old fun things from the old life that you're going to have to detach from. Not going to be easy. I don't know, the transition from McDonald's to kosher delight. Now, velimud is a lot of learning that has to be done. Oh, you got to know what you're approaching. It's not a simple business. Umila, right, is the big deterrent. Mila. Are you ready to do that? Umasim toyim rabim. And there's a lot of things that I'll have to do. 613 to be more specific. V'shiinag b'minogenu. Not enough that he says what we say. That he accepts the belief. No, he's got to live the way we live. And it's a big business. It's a rigorous business. Now in parentheses, he explains the significance of Mila. Part of the idea of Mila is it's that we carry that divine imprint on our bodies. Now, we have different signs, right? Different badges that we wear of our connection with Hashem. One of the most prominent ones is tefillin. Other such things. But Hashem wanted something to actually be on us at all times, like the Medrash said about David HaMelech. Something that even when we're in the bath, when we're in the bathhouse, it's still manifest. So therefore, he chose the wants something to be on the body. The question is, why there? And a forehead would be a more appropriate place. Why did Hashem choose the organ upon which Mila is performed? So he says, that organ was chosen specifically. Hashem specifically instructed that that divine badge will be in the organ where the physical, where sensationalism is most manifest. Sorry, sensuality is most manifest. Where the base instincts of a person is most manifest, but where potentially the lowest aspects of a person is most manifest. Hashem wants a tapka there. First of all, if that's the organ that carries the badge of Hashem, certainly you'll use that organ only in the right way. Now, and that really is not just, you know, technicality of keeping that organ in check. That's really a means of establishing who you are. This is a fundamental point. You know, let's first let the Kuzari finish his sentence. Ba'anochas hazera karoi, to go about using the organ in the right way. In the right way, ube'es sheroi, and at the right times, v'kasheroi, and in the right manner, meaning, for us that's not a hefker area. For us, that is a very important part of our service of Hashem. And there are all kinds of restrictions and all kinds of commands, and you can't just run wild. Again, you have to remember that that organ per se is what's carrying that divine badge. Now, I just want to elaborate on this a little bit more. We have to understand that really this is representative of everything Judaism stands for. Judaism stands for, right, in the minds of the Goyim, as far as the Goyim are concerned, there is sanctity and there is impurity. And these activities are clearly in the realm of impurity. And therefore, a person who lives a life of holiness doesn't engage in these things, or claims not to engage in these things. Right? Because these things are conflict with sanctity. Now, what's at the core of this? At the core of this is that there are two forces in the world. There's evil and there's good. And the two conflict, and there's a realm that just completely has nothing to do with Kedusha. But if we believe in one Hashem, who made everything, and nothing happened outside of His control, right? There's nothing that, you know, when He was setting it up, it went a little awry, lost control of the machines. Any human function is a part of Hashem's plan. And we manifest this by showing that, on the contrary, what they consider the lowest of things, we bring into the realm of Kedusha. And therefore, that actually manifests the greatest level of Kedusha. That manifests the greatest level of Kedusha because we're showing quite how all-encompassing Hashem's domain is. And that's why, for example, Gemara says, Bilam HaRasha, he was called the man of one eye. He was missing an eye. Right? He was missing an eye. When did he lose that eye? The Gemara tells us when he lost that eye. It says, among the things that he said when he was having his prophecy, he was having visions of Hashem's relationship with the Jewish people that he put into his own words. That's basically what all the brachas of Bilam are about. He was seeing amazing things of how Hashem relates to the Jewish people, and he put them into his own words. That's why Chazal, on the one hand, it's such a fundamental expression of Hashem's love for the Jewish people. On the other hand, Chazal picked up all kinds of nuances where you see Bilam's personality showing through. Now, we won't get into that full discussion, but one point is, he says, Mimono Afar Yaakov Omisparis Revai Yisrael. Among Bilam's blessings, he says, who is it that counts the dirt of Yaakov Omisparis Revai Yisrael? Who is it, the way Chazal expound this is, that counts the seed of Klal Yisrael? What does that mean? So Chazal say that Bilam had an astounding vision. He saw Hashem, Kiviyachol, sorting through seeds in anticipation of what each cell of seed is going to become. Each Jew for Hashem, kiveyachol, is a subject of anticipation. Each of us, we have to realize this, because Havavitz expresses this in his way. Each of us is something that Hashem conceived in advance. You see yourself in the mirror, you're very happy with yourself, but you don't realize that for Hashem, you, kiveyachol, okay, I'm allowing myself to use these words, are a dream come true. You're something Hashem was imagining and picturing and planning way before you came into existence. Hashem was anticipating the arrival of you. Individually, Hashem never had anybody like you before. Right? He's been picturing you and planning you and anticipating your arrival. And this is expressed by Chazal saying that he was actually looking, kiviyachol, excitedly at the seed of Klal Yisrael. What? Yeah. Now, Bilam sees this, and this is something Bilam can't grasp. Because as far as Bilam is concerned, that whole area is in the realm of Tumah. There's nothing holy about that. That is the way the earlier philosophers put it. This is one of a disgrace of man, this whole realm. So Bilam said, the holy Hashem, Mishahu Kodesh V'Torah Mishosav Kodesh V'Torim, he who is so holy and pure, and whose servants are so holy and pure, the Malachim, Yistakel V'Dabar Zeh, this is what he's looking at? Miad Nismei Seinam Shalei Seh Hashem. Because I'll say it was then that he lost one eye. Okay, that's a discussion in itself, why the one eye was the result, but let's leave that for now. But the truth is, he was again failing to grasp what by us is a fundamental tenet of our faith, and that is that yes, the domain of Hashem encompasses everything, and our greatness is in the fact that we bring what for the outside people are the most base and disgusting activities into the realm of Kedusha, into the highest realms of Kedusha. This is something that deserves elaboration, but we'll suffice with that right now. You know what? I'll just give one more point on this. One more point. I can't do this. One more point. The Maharal says something amazing. The Maharal says that, I forgot exactly how he works it into the Chazal, but basically, he says that there's a place where Chazal lists what people have in common with Malachim, and what people have in common with animals. Right? We eat and drink like animals. A few different contrasts. And Chazal notes that while it says that we multiply, the actual act of procreation, the actual act, is not listed as something that we share that we have in common with animals. And the Maharal says something amazing. He says, now, why not? Lamaisa is something we have in common with animals. The Maharal says we don't. On a very superficial level, it looks like the same act, but it's really something completely different. With animals, it's two beings getting together, each filling its own needs, and this is a basic part of how the world functions, and Hashem set up that attraction in order for the world to continue. With us, it's a completely different thing. It's an end in and of itself of unity. It's not two things getting together. When it's done right, by the right people, in the right way, which is, means that's supposed to be all of us, it's actually just a complete merge, right? It's blending together. It might, to the physical eye, look like two bodies, but it's really not. There's a merging of souls here that's really just one. And that's why the Maharal says it is so fundamental, it's a very fundamental halacha in these areas, to be very, very, very discreet about it. Now, we all understand that. Sure, you should be discreet. It's not something you want to go publicizing, right? But there's something deeper to it. Maharal says that the truth is that in the minds of the couple, there are not two parties here. They're completely joining. And that's what's really going on the deeper level. But any outsider who observes this won't see that. He sees, to the physical eye, there are two bodies here. But it's really not true. While this is going on, it's all just one. To the extent, he says, that that's why Amiroim were so particular about this that they would even make sure that there were no flies in their room at the time. Why no flies? He says, because then again, it's manifesting in a physical way. There's a physical eye that perceives two here. And that conflicts with the whole concept. There isn't two here. In their minds, there's only one. On the essential level, there's only one. and therefore it shouldn't be manifest, be perceived by any physical eye, in any physical ways too. So, in other words, okay, we'll leave it at that, but what we're saying is that dafka, by choosing the organ of the milah, that's where Hashem imprints his badge, right, of his service. That's by showing that, yes, the essence of the Jew is that everything, there's nothing about us that's not included in the realm of our service of Hashem. There's nothing about us, well, yeah, I have my relationship with Hashem, but there are the parts of life that are outside of that. No, Hashem's relationship with us and Hashem's domain encompasses everything. The things that the outside world would consider most unlikely. And that's why Davka the Mila. That's why Davka the Mila is... Davka, this organ, is chosen as the place for the Mila. Okay. Now, but back to the Ger, right? We're demanding all this of the Ger. We pile on a tough lift of a list of requirements. Like, again, like the Kuzari pointed out earlier, this distinguishes us from the other nations. We're not a membership club. We're not interested. We have no need to evangelize. Anybody wants, we give them a hard time and we pile on the demands. Can you put all this in your pipe and smoke it? A person who can attach himself to all this, non-Jew, yes, he now can enter our fold and attain this closeness with Hashem. He can earn it for him and his family. However, he says, at the same time, let's remember that there was a very fundamental point that the Kuzari kept stressing back at the beginning, and that is that Jews are inherently a different creation than non-Jews. And therefore, at the end of the day, even a non-Jew who converts does not attain the same biological reality, if we'll call it that, spiritual biology, okay? But will not attain the same biological reality as the Jew. Meaning, not that he's limited in how close he can get with Hashem and how high he can get in Olam Haba, but in this world, there are certain limitations that he can't get. There are certain things he can't get to, because that only works for the real thing. The place this manifests is in Nevuah. Nevuah, only a biological Jew can get. Vizulasam, now all the rest. So yes, they might be missing out on something in this world. There's something that they can't get to in this world. But as far as that eternal connection, as far as getting their place in Olam Haba, all avenues are open. Tachlis in Yonam. Their ultimate is sheyikablu mehem, that they'll be accepted. Visheyiyu chachamim v'chassidim. Yes, they can reach levels of great chachamim, great chassidim. They can become from the most pious members of Klal Yisrael, as has been the case in many instances. Achloi nevim. But prophets they won't become. That's a certain limitation. That at the end of the day depends on being from the breed of Avraham Avinu. No, I'm sorry. She wasn't a neviah. There was one instance of a ger navi, Ovadia navi. Ovadia navi was a ger, and the Zohar explains that this was an exception to the rule, because Ovadia was the one who prophesied the downfall of Edom, of Rome. Well, Edom is really more than Rome, but we'll call it Rome for our purposes. Now, the Zohar says something very interesting, and I'm just citing it in an approximate way. I don't completely understand what he says. In an approximate way, he says that Rome, we know that, not Rome, I shouldn't say Rome, it's not really correct. Edom and the Jewish people are on a seesaw. Meaning, one's up, the other is down. One's up, the other is down. And therefore, a Jew cannot really tap into the reality of a destroyed Edom. To really be able to prophesy, which really means to be able to experience the destruction of Edom, can only be done by an Edomite. And therefore, this particular Nevuah could only be done by a descendant of Edom. And therefore, in this case, there was an exception to the rule, and an Edomi Ger became a prophet, because that was the only person who could possibly prophesize about and actually live in the reality of a destroyed Edom. But other than that, we say that Nevuah per se is limited to Jews, but yet, the ultimate destiny of the Jewish people, yes, a non-Jew who's ready to take it all on can join and become a part of it. Alright, I think that next week we're finishing the first chelek, the first section of Sefer HaKuzari. Let's see.